Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss whether Trump was the big loser from the midterms, the war on nicotine, and whether or not we've reached peak wank. Hello and welcome to Last Orders, a Spike podcast. My name's Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined all the way from the South Coast on Zoom or Squadcast or whatever this is. Chris Snowden, the director of lifestyle economics at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris. How are you doing?
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Not too bad, thank you. Not too bad. We're delighted to be joined today by Nick Gillespie. Nick's the editor at large of Reason. He also hosts the Reason Interview, appears on the weekly Reason Roundtable podcast over there, known to many of our listeners, I'm sure. Nick, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
It is my pleasure to be talking to you from New York City, and I apologize in advance, not just for my voice, which has gone missing, but a good chunk of my brain, which was last seen in around 1998. But here I am.
What a brilliant place to start, especially as we're talking about, you know, something which is really very much a kind of damp squib, it turned out to be. So the midterms were this week, Nick. There was a lot of talk going into it about there being a red wave that voters were going to punish the Democrats for doddery Joe Biden's rule. And the red wave kind of turned into a trickle, a puddle. You can kind of pick your disappointing metaphor, as people have. The gains in the House don't seem to be that big.
I think it is a prostate challenge bloody urine flow.
I was looking for a headline for this podcast. So.
It is a trickle. It's there. It's real. And it's a little bit red, but not a lot of volume.
There's still a lot of results coming in. So some of those might change by the time people actually listen to this. But generally, it looks disappointing.
It is for the Republicans. I mean, for the rest of us, it's pretty good. And it's not great for the Democrats. I mean, you know, the top line results are people going in, including myself. I expected the Democrats to lose somewhere between 30 and 50 seats in the House of Representatives and really lose, not just lose the majority, but be facing a large Republican one. That's not going to happen. The Republicans will take the House, but they'll probably have a single digit majority, which is not a lot to work with. And then there was, a belief or an anticipation that they would take the Senate with a majority of, you know, like 3 to 4 to 5 seats. It's probably going to be really close. It'll be within 1 or 2. It's likely they'll still take that. But, so what went from what was expected to be an absolutely unequivocal rebuke of the 2 years of terrible policies under Joe Biden and a Democratic majority in both houses of Congress has turned out to be, I think, and I say this from a libertarian perspective where I don't care for either the Democrats or the Republicans, in a lot of ways, it was a rebuke to both parties saying that we are not playing a game. Voters have been playing this game pretty much the past 20 years where every 2, 4, 6 years, one majority gets wiped out and the other one gets brought in. And that was a referendum on the previous management. You know, Republicans under George Bush had solid control for 6 years. And then people were like, you know what? You have dragged us into stupid wars. You are spending more money than anybody since LBJ. You are filled with liars and ineffective policy people. You're out. And then they brought in the Democrats, you know, and then Barack Obama won. In his first midterm elections, the Democrats got what he felicitously called a shellacking and got blown out. Then he comes back. Trump actually won in 2016, lost the House in 2018 because people were sick of Republicans. And in a way, I see this election, you know, basically the country is saying we're refusing to give either of these parties a majority is kind of a creeping sense of sanity that you both suck and that you are both undeserving of the ability to force your monstrous, stupid, oftentimes completely delusional and really ineffective and harmful agendas on the country. So that's the positive spin, I think, from a non-tribal political point of view.
And it's interesting that it produced such a mixed results, or it didn't seem to kind of G up the respective tribes to the degree that they might want to, given how heightened the rhetoric was. So on the Democratic side, it was, this is the most important election ever. Democracy is on the table.
Oh, God. I mean, it was worse than that because I'm 59 and I guess I don't know when I turned 18, you know, you guys figure the math out. You know, Brits are better at that, I assume, than I am. But, you know, every election that I've ever, you know, been cognizant of, they say it's the most important election. And what was even worse here is the Democrats were saying this might be the last election. If the Republican majority really took over in a true red wave, you know, where they just like let it rip and piss their pants and, you know, made us streams mightier than the Mississippi River, it would be over. Authoritarians would shut down all future elections. I mean, people were talking that way. It was insane and delusional. And it's great to see that, you know, just completely taken off the table. On the Republican side, they were talking about how this was, you know, it was like Stalingrad, except for, you know, Marxist communists, you know, taking over. And that if, you know, if we don't defeat this person or that person, it's socialism, you know, it's you know, the Soviet Union 2.0. And it's kind of good to see that rebuked. And what you see in a lot of different places, you see a judicious splitting of, I don't know if the term is used in England, of kind of ballot splitting. Mm-hmm. So you have people like in Georgia, which was a big state, the anti-Trump governor, Brian Kemp, won re-election against Stacey Abrams, who refused to concede her loss 4 years ago. He won massively, won by, I think, double digits, or it'll turn out to be like around 10 points. But then other people down the line who were very highly affiliated with Trump, it was like, no, we're not going there, and things like that. And for me, one of the places where you see this new kind of reality, I think, in a positive way, in Colorado, there's a congresswoman named Lauren Boebert who, you know, believes that the elections were stolen. She believes, you know, that many Democrats are active pedophiles. I mean, every insane theory you can see. She got beat by a guy who is not a member of the Progressive Caucus. You know, he is not somebody who says we need to nationalize healthcare and we need to nationalize the railroads and, you know, get rid of private school or anything. It's a pro-business Democrat who believes in things like free speech and, you know, like lower, you know, reasonable taxes, reasonable business regulation, who's pro-immigrant and things like that. These are heartwarming after decades of, you know, just really bad political outcomes.
Mm-hmm. And you make a good point there about how there's been a lot of talk about Republican kind of democracy deniers, but there's a lot of that to go around on the Democratic side as well. It's a little more acceptable. It's a little more Stacey Abrams, but there's still a lot of the same thing. I suppose the other question is, it's generally seen as a bad night for Trump, as you've alluded to, that essentially DeSantis is now the re-elected Florida governor, sort of in the ascendancy as the kind of smart Trumpism done well, Trumpism with a brain, you know, pick your description. Is that a fair assumption? Do you think the kind of Trump train is screeched to a halt at this point?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, I think that's a pretty solid read of things, that Trump is still powerful. And, you know, in two successive presidential elections, Trump got like 46% of the vote, a little bit more than 46%, but under 47% of the popular vote. He has demonstrated clearly that his upper limit of popular support in America is not a majority of Americans. And what he did in this election cycle, he pushed a series, particularly in the Senate, of candidates who, you know, most charitably can be described as idiots, you know, as terrible human people who have, you know, who are mean, angry, and have a very tenuous connection to reality. And in often cases, zero experience. So like the people, most of the high profile people he backed did poorly. They either flat out lost or they might eke out a victory where they should have won by a vast majority. So that's a good sign, I think, for America. I actually didn't mind Trump as president. His actual policies, some of them were terrible, and he like all presidents spends too much money, and he increased the debt like at historic rates and things like that. But he wasn't, you know, I'm not a Trump hater or anything like that. But after losing and refusing to concede, he has, you know, he's been nothing but a negative influence on American politics. And it's good to see his anointed, you know, crew just kind of mostly getting their asses kicked or having to squeak out, really sweat out races that they should have won easily.
And Chris, we should move on to nicotine in a second, but how do you feel about Trump being knocked back? I know that from afar, you know, as the greatest stand-up comedian of our age, Donald Trump, you appreciate him quite a bit, but are you sad to see him go, Chris, or at least at this point?
Yeah, I am really. For the reasons you gave, he's easily the funniest, I would say the funniest politician of all time, not just the funniest president of all time. And I still think he has a lot to give, you know. But the main thing is he gets back on Twitter. We'll come to that later on. As long as he's still tweeting, then I can live with him not being president. But yeah, there's a lot of banter that could be had from him being president. But maybe it's a good thing, you know. You can never really go back. You can't repeat the past. It probably wouldn't be as funny again. So, yeah, it's maybe it's a blessing in disguise.
I really, you know, in 2019, I think I went to CPAC, this gigantic, you know, conservative conference where he gave a famous, like a 2.5 hour long speech. I mean, it was like Castro, you know, to this crowd of people who absolutely loved him. I mean, you know, this was, you know, he was like Led Zeppelin, you know, at the peak of their fame or something. Everybody in the audience would have slept with him that night. You know, it's like, and it was a great speech, Chris. It, to your point, it was funny and it was totally unscripted. And he just was making fun of the Democrats, other Republicans, talking about stuff. It was like a fantastic stand-up, you know, comedian act. But, you know, when you look at how things have played out and the people, you know, I'm a libertarian, so I believe in having terrible vocal cords. And I, you know, but I believe in, you know, immigration. I believe in free trade. I believe in free markets. I believe in, you know, letting all sorts of weird people live their lives the way they want to. And Trump really stands athwart that now. And he has this awful vision of wanting to go back to the past, to his imagined beautiful past where everything works for him. And whatever it did for him, the people who were following in his footsteps are just disasters if they actually gain political power. And so I'm glad that that influence seems to be waning. He still may well, I mean, he's probably going to run for president and he may get the Republican nomination. I don't think he has any chance of winning. And I'm not a fan of Ron DeSantis, but Ron DeSantis is, you know, he is Trump 2.0. He is younger, smarter, more lucid, and has a successful, he had a successful term as governor of Florida. You know, he won the Florida governorship 4 years ago, barely. I mean, by, you know, like as small a margin as you could do. And he kicked ass this time. So in a lot of ways, his model, whatever that is, has got to be seen as the presumptive future of the Republican Party.
Definitely.
I saw Dr. Oz was running in one of the states.
Pennsylvania. Yes.
What was all that about? How did that come about? He's a complete crackpot, isn't he?
Yeah, he is a snake oil salesman. You know, yeah. I mean, he was so bad. I mean, this is a guy who is an actual MD. His colleagues at Columbia University and Columbia Hospital are petitioning always to get him thrown off because he's a quack. He will sell any idiotic cure, you know, that people will pay him to promote and whatnot. It wasn't even clear that he actually lived in Pennsylvania. And, you know, he was running against the lieutenant governor, John Fetterman, who had a stroke. Fetterman on the campaign trail, and they had one debate. And it was Fetterman when, you know, at the debate, this is how bad Fetterman was. They said, you know, John Fetterman, your opening statement. And his first word was, good night. You know, it's like, and the point is not that Fetterman is terrible, but Oz lost to John Fetterman because he has no political experience. He had no real agenda about anything. He couldn't definitively say how many houses he owned. I mean, he was, you know, he's a TV savvy guy, but he's an empty suit. And to show you what a petty person Trump is in the American papers today, Trump is like, oh, well, you know, Oz lost, but I never really liked him. He handpicked Oz over a Republican politician who would have beaten Fetterman like a, you know, like a rented mule. But he said Melania was the one who wanted Oz, and that was a big mistake. She really messed
that up. Threw his wife under the bus.
Usually he only throws the wives of other, you know, Republican candidates under the bus, like Ted Cruz.
Your wife's a dog.
You know, he supported other people, you know, like Herschel Walker, who is a big American football star as a college player and had a good professional career too, who again, you know, was running on a anti-abortion ticket, like that all abortion is evil. And then, you know, with every passing week, it seemed like somebody else came forward to say, oh, here is one of Herschel Walker's illegitimate children. But also here are receipts of him paying for my abortion. And, you know, these were the types of candidates for the Senate in particular that the Republicans ran in. And again, this was an election where, by all the indicators, the Republicans should have won gigantically. And they ran at all levels terrible candidates that really dampened, you know, their ability to win. And again, I don't care about the Republicans or the Democrats. What I like coming out of this is I think the American people have shown a little bit of like, okay, you know what, this, we're not playing this game anymore. Mm-hmm. We're not just going, we hate you Democrats because you've been in power for a couple of years and you really fucked things up. So we're going with the Republican. I wouldn't be surprised if visa applications and immigration applications for England start kicking up, because I think people are like, we got to get out of this. Whatever this is, we don't want it anymore.
I think my favorite thing about Herschel Walker was that talk about him in his own autobiography, talking about playing Russian roulette on his own one night, and then also coming very close to killing a man because he delivered his car late. And you think this is the sort of best that they could...
That's the leadership, the leadership we need right now. He also talked about having multiple personality disorder, which he cured through prayer. So it's like, you know, and that's kind of fascinating then, because multiple personality disorder doesn't really exist and prayer doesn't really fix things. So it's like, Herschel, you are a Picasso of bullshit, you know, at that point.
Have you joined Spike Supporters yet? Spike Supporters is our thriving donor community where those who donate to Spike regularly can access all kinds of exclusive perks. You can comment on articles, get free tickets to events and much more. Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters. Chris, let's talk about some of the stories that you picked out this month, which seem to circle around attempts, particularly by the FDA, to just get nicotine out of cigarettes, which seems, isn't nicotine supposed to be the good bit of cigarettes, which is slightly confusing to me. But do you want to talk us through these developments? And it mirrors things going on in New Zealand as well.
Yeah. Well, it was really the New Zealand effort that most caught my eye, because ASH New Zealand, which is obviously the equivalent of ASH USA and ASH UK, Action on Smoking Health, they're actually opposed to this. And these people are never opposed to any anti-smoking policies, but even they can see that taking nearly all the nicotine out of cigarettes is going to be counterproductive. So it's an idea that's been floating around for years, decades, but it always gets nipped in the bud because somebody says, well, this is stupid. You're taking out the thing that doesn't harm people, that people smoke for, and you're leaving in all the stuff that kills them. And you know, no one's going to buy these products. And if you make them the only cigarettes available, then people just go to the black market. And people always go, yeah, that's a fair point. And it gets ditched for another 10 years, and it comes back from somebody else. But the FDA, as Nick knows very well, it has control over tobacco, has had for years. And they have a system whereby the FDA essentially authorizes tobacco products now, but they include e-cigarettes as tobacco products because the nicotine in them comes from tobacco. And then when the industry started using synthetic nicotine, they said, oh, we'll include that as tobacco too, right? Didn't even try and justify it as a real product of tobacco.
Well, and also I remember some of the early justifications for extending FDA regulation to e-cigarettes is that it looks like smoking. Mm. So, you know, because they mimicked, a tube that has, you know, a cloud coming out of it.
Right. They basically just want to take control of all non-pharmaceutical nicotine, and they've done that very successfully. Or they've done it anyway. They have not been so successful actually in authorizing these products. So cigarettes are already on the shelves. They're fine. They don't need any kind of authorization. But anything else does. And believe it or not, they have so far received 6.7 million applications for various, mainly vape products. So each individual vape juice has to go through this process, even though most of them are essentially identical Of those 6.7 million, I don't know exactly what the latest figure is, but it's something like 30 have been approved. And that includes things like e-cigarette batteries, you know. It's a ridiculous and obviously incredibly bureaucratic and time-consuming system. Anyway, one of the few products that has been approved is a very low nicotine cigarette. And I mean so low that essentially, you know, you wouldn't touch a side. You wouldn't even notice it's got nicotine in it. This has been approved as a harm reduction product, something that has all the harm of smoking and none of the benefits. And of course, people aren't buying it because why would you? But the idea eventually, I think, is to ban, you know, normal cigarettes and leave those being the only thing on the market. That's certainly and very explicitly the plan in New Zealand. And whereas the US probably wouldn't, you know, in practice, they probably won't go down this route because there'll be so many court cases and what have you. Sense will eventually prevail of it. In New Zealand, Jacinda is using this very much as part of her legacy, and she is doing it. They've legislated for it. They're going to go ahead with it unless there's a late U-turn. And they think they can get away with it in New Zealand, I guess, because they're in the middle of nowhere, down in the South Pacific. And, you know, where are people going to go if they can't buy their normal cigarettes? Well, the reality is they'll buy them from the black market, and then the black market is growing at quite a pace.
They'll swim to Australia.
Yeah, well, yeah.
It's not that far on the map.
A new small boats crisis.
It's like 2 hours on the flight, actually. People think the two places are closer than they are. But either way, the Chinese smuggling gangs have decided there is a decent market for them in New Zealand, the country of 5 million people, because the price of cigarettes is so incredibly high there, so the margin is pretty good. And, of course, they'll do exactly the same thing if they get the nicotine out of cigarettes. So it's just a really dumb way of bringing in prohibition, hoping that people won't notice it's prohibition, right? It's like if you ban vodka and then give someone a glass of water and go, well, it looks the same. You can drink it the same, you know. What do you mean we banned alcohol? No, we just banned this particular, we just cut down the amount of alcohol that you can have in a drink, which, of course, is what they did in the 20s in America with prohibition. They still had, near beer was legal, but it was like 0.5%. It wasn't really going to do it for the average beer drinker.
Chris, can I ask, what is the impetus against nicotine per se? Is it that it's the addictive substance? I mean, like, you're right. And I remember these debates in the U.S. go back decades where, you know, tobacco companies, basically to assuage government regulators, were trying to come up with lower nicotine cigarettes, which just meant that people smoked more cigarettes to get their nicotine fix. And it's the smoking that's bad. So it's like, in the name of pursuing safety, you know, to reduce nicotine levels, you actually get people to do more of the bad stuff, as you were saying. But is the anger against nicotine simply that it is the habit forming part of this?
Yeah, basically. I mean, the idea, such as it is that if you take out, you know, 99% of the nicotine, then they'll no longer be addictive. And once they're no longer addictive, people will no longer consume them.
So just the tar, all the good stuff.
There was in the United States, in California, there was a ballot initiative that passed with flying colors, unfortunately. You know, and this is like an open voter referendum where the citizens decide rather than the legislature. And upheld a ban on flavored vapes.
Proposition 31, right?
You know, the FDA, which did, to the extent that it had anything to do with COVID, both in terms of authorizing or approving vaccines, it took forever. And really, you know, it's dawdling. They did not even work through Thanksgiving weekend in 2021 because they're like, you know, we've got to live or something. You know, while the vaccines were being approved, they delayed the rollout of the vaccines at a time when, you know, every week you could have saved X number of people, conceivably. And they also tried to monopolize testing and other aspects where the FDA just fucked up COVID response as much as they had one. But they are, you know, they have been trying to just squelch vaping, which is clearly a healthier alternative to smoking. And it, you know, from an American point of view, this is really a question of, and from certainly from a libertarian point of view, is like, how bad does a government agency have to do, and how, you know, acting in bad faith or through incompetence, like how bad do they have to get before they get canned? But they've been attacking vaping from the beginning. And then in California, one of the ways that they've been doing this is getting rid of flavored vapes because they say that only kids, you know, use flavored vapes, et cetera. And, it's just the worst kind of nanny state overreach. I mean, it's like, can you let people do anything that they enjoy that is either not harmful to them or is substantially less harmful to them than the alternative. It's very frustrating. And if I may, I hate to be a US-centric, but fuck it. You know, I'm an American, so I realize everything revolves around America. But it's like, these are the types of conversations that we don't have in the United States anymore, because politics has become so tribal and so personality driven. So, you know, we end up talking about, oh, did Trump's little minions, did they do well or not? Did Joe Biden, you know, is Joe Biden senile? You know, like, instead of talking about actual policy questions as they relate to just living a free life, of having life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's very frustrating. And as you can tell, both from my voice and my anger, I obviously did not get my nicotine hit this morning.
Well, as you know, there's been a massive, you know, hysteria about youth vaping in particular in America, yeah, which we've never really had in England, fortunately. And you've got people like Mike Bloomberg around. So that Proposition 31 in California, overwhelmingly funded, the campaign for it was overwhelmingly funded by Mike Bloomberg. I think he put about $30 million in out of a total war chest of like $32 million. I think the opposition put in about $3 million, the whole, you know, yeah, probably the tobacco industry, the vape industry, whatever. Massively outnumbered. And this guy is doing this all around the world. He's put in at least 120 million worldwide just to ban e-cigarette flavors. And so out of nowhere in the last two or three years has been this kind of global push to ban e-cigarette flavors. And as far as I can see, it's all coming from this one evil, twisted old man who could be using that money in a million better ways if he wants to promote health, you know?
To fund Spiked Online, right? I mean, he could be funding Reason or whatever. It's like, you know, where are the fruit? Where are the fruit lobbies to say, no, you're not getting rid of mango, you're not getting rid of banana or strawberry or chocolate? You know, like, these are our flavors. You know, it's deeply troubling, you know, because vaping, you know, it's one of those things. And I guess there are other instances of this where vaping, you know, and the whole dream of the e-cigarette, a cigarette that is less dangerous, but allows people to get something that they want and to have a pleasurable ritual and experience and psychopharmacological experience that they're in control of. You know, you finally get vaping and then people are like, now we got to shut this down. There's something just sickening, I find, in, you know, in this nanny statism. I don't know if that term is still in use in England. That has kind of faded. But, you know, the nanny state used to be something that we talked about more consciously and more explicitly. And again, I think it's partly because, you know, when democracy is on the line, just shut up and vote against vaping, because, you know, we have more important things to do. There might never be another election, you know, if this person gets elected. So in the United States, we don't talk about policy anymore. And that is, you know, it was so incredibly frustrating, because ultimately policy is, you know, is where the action is and should be. And it needs to be tied into these larger issues of, like, here is a vision of what government should do in order to enable more people to live meaningful lives or not. And we just don't have that.
I mean, while we're on the topic of public debate, let's talk a bit about Twitter. So this has been another, I suppose, big sort of panic amongst a lot of the denizens of Twitter now that Elon Musk has finally taken it over.
Yeah.
Nick, there has, you know, before we can get into whether or not we think he's going to be good or bad for free speech on that particular platform, what do you make of the response to it? Because people were quite explicitly saying this is going to unleash hatred, that this is like hanging out in a bar in Weimar, Germany, the evening before the Nazis take over. There was this kind of sense of, like, free speech equals fascism.
Right. No, I actually, it's more like hanging out in a Bavarian beer hall. You know, it's like, oh, you know, we were just nice Germans and now Elon Musk has shown up. And, you know, the term that everybody says is that Twitter is a hellscape. And it's, you know, since Elon Musk took over, and I think we're in like the second week of his ownership, and people are like, I cannot believe how debased this platform, which I've been fucking moaning about for 10 years, is now just, it's irredeemable. It is beyond moral panic. I mean, effectively, nothing has changed on Twitter, and people are acting as if, like, you know, finally, you know, it's as if David Icke has been proved right. And you realize that Twitter is just filled with lizard people, you know, and royal family members who are controlling everything. It's like, yeah, it's a pure hysterical play. That's all. Like, that the ownership of this, I don't know that he'll be able to, Yeah, I don't know that he will like owning Twitter. I don't know that it will become better or worse. I mean, there have been a couple of marginal improvements that are good that have been in the works for a long time. But for God's sake, when you take, you know, somebody who's taken over a platform with billions of users, or, you know, and like, and you're saying after 2 weeks, you know, he's fired people who were working here. How dare he? Like, what the fuck? You know, it's just hysterical.
That sense that they, as in the people we're talking about, owned it, and that they feel so shocked and hurt that anyone else is trying to kind of mess with its rules. It's really quite pronounced. It's also kind of quite pronounced how even a lot of people in America, you know, the land of the First Amendment, essentially do want European style hate speech laws. They just know they can't get it on statute. So they have to get some platform to at least impose it for them. Like they'll settle for that. But there is, it has been striking the kind of desire for censorship effectively amongst the American allegedly liberal intelligentsia. But
we call it, you know, moderation. And on a certain point, it's true. You know, I believe Twitter is a private platform and Twitter can set its rules of engagement and things like that. And I also know that everybody wants some level of moderation because, you know, it's kind of like if you went over to your friend's party and there were a bunch of louts who just were screaming and shouting and breaking things, you would probably be like, yeah, I'm going to leave. You know, or it's like, I would rather that you kind of regulated these people in some kind of way. The promise of social media in particular was that you can do that by empowering, you know, the user to shape their experience in the way that they want. While, you know, so it's really kind of like a, you know, a kind of John Stuart Mill experiment and living, you know, writ large, where you can have millions of different communities flourishing next to one another, engaging each other when they want or not. I mean, it's like, it is a framework for a real great, you know, liberal polity online and things like that. And you're right that at all of these companies or outside people saying these companies should not be allowed to allow the kind of speech I don't want. So I want to either push them through advertiser boycotts or through legislation to change things. What is bizarre in the United States, and it's partly due to the statutory law, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which allows for platforms to moderate and not to be held liable for user-generated content if it's legal content, not if it's illegal, they can get into trouble. But both the right and the left now, for different reasons, want to change the business models of social media platform. And so you have somebody like a Ron DeSantis who says Twitter moderates too much speech. So I am passing a law, or the Florida legislature and him passed a law saying now Twitter is not free to do their business the way they want. And then you have people on the left who are like, Twitter has to moderate much, much more. But the takeaway, and this is what worries me, is that when you get the right and the left kind of coming to a common conclusion, which is this stuff needs to be regulated by people like me, that's very worrying. And I like the fact that Elon Musk, you know, took over Twitter. We'll see if it works or not. I mean, I don't think it's going to be a lot of fun for him, but Twitter is a really useful platform. I like it because I see things I wouldn't see otherwise. And I realize that's exactly why a lot of people want to kill it. You know, and it can be a right winger or a left winger, but they're so terrified that they'll see a stray comment or an image or a headline that upsets them. And, you know,
even though it's so easy to filter that stuff out even now.
Yeah, of course. It's one button, just to go back to the midterms. I don't know if this got play in the UK but the New York Times, this is kind of emblematic of where America is. And like there's right-wing snowflakes and left-wing snowflakes, but the New York Times is obviously a paper of record for left-wing snowflakes. But they said, you know, the midterms are stressful. Here are six ways to cope. And like one of them was do five finger breathing where you like put your hand in front of your face and calm down. Another was, you know, take a cold shower. The fifth of the six things was literally breathe like a baby. Like if you're getting too upset over the midterms, breathe like a baby.
How do babies
work? It's like, you know, yeah, well, you know, poorly. I mean, I'm a father. I've had two kids. Like, you know, you're not like babies aren't like, you know, a Dr. Oz yoga master. They're not doing these long, deep breathings, you know, that are cycling the impurities out of your chakras. babies like whine and wheeze and cry. But the point is that we've reached a point now where this may be too far afield, but fuck it. I don't get to use my literary degree very much, but like Edgar Allan Poe's The Fall of the House of Usher is best read as a parody, in my mind, of English romanticism, particularly like, Wordsworth and Keats. And the two main characters in that, like, if they get hit by a beam of light, it's like physically a punishment to them. It's almost like breaking their bones. And I feel like America now are like, you know, Roderick Usher and his sister, where it's like, if you see the slightest thing, it's like you're this overripe fruit that is about to be bruised. And so there is this mania, particularly in social media platforms, where it's like one of the last places where people can kind of speak freely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for that reason, we need to shut it down. It takes a different term, a different flavor than I think European speech regulations, which I want to hear you guys talk about.
I mean, on that front, we got some semi-good news in the UK recently, in that the online safety bill, which was going to bring in this new requirement on social media firms to limit what it called legal but harmful speech, looks like it's going to be revised to try and take out that particular measure. There's all kinds of other things that are wrong with it, but just essentially creating that extra layer of speech regulation and essentially doing what you often see across the piece, really, which is you effectively have the state put the burden on the social media companies to censor. So it's not even that they're doing this of their own volition. Yeah. You even see a bit in America to an arguable degree, insofar as the back and forth between politics and Silicon Valley. But at the same time, we kind of celebrate one very minor victory for online speech in this regard. Could be quite significant, but it's something that wasn't on the books yet. Meanwhile, there's still people being arrested for posting spicy memes on the internet, which continues to be a thing.
I love that phrase, legal but harmful. It reminds me of the old Ali G sketch where on his HBO show in the US, he went around to a bunch of porn people, porn crusaders, anti-porn crusaders. And he was like, okay, so, I know what legal is and I know what illegal is, but what is barely, which is a popular porn category. And I was thinking when I saw the illegal or legal but harmful, what about barely legal but harmful?
Don't give them ideas. This is what
it's insanity. And may I say this, I know you guys are, you're philosophically schooled or you're interested in the larger picture stuff. Like, what a terrible outcome that we've finally gotten to a place where we've created these public fora where everybody can participate. Finally, I mean, this is the liberal dream, right? Of like emancipation from hierarchy and from authority and repressive governments, whether it's, based on the divine right of kings or will to power or something like, we finally have these open air, Hyde Parks and Union Squares where like everybody can get on a soapbox and talk. You don't have to listen to them, but it's like, it's the delivery of one of the greatest visions of human flourishing and kind of, free thought. And we're trying to shut it down because people get their, knickers in a twist over errant images or something like that. Obviously you don't want like eggheads marching on, Brussels or something like that, professors are terrible at picket lines, but like, and I guess, part of the problem is professors are part of the problem here. But, God, it's like, let's zoom out a little bit and see, like, how insane is this that we finally, a place like Twitter is kind of totally fucking great. And we're saying, no, we have to shut it down to make it as boring as the BBC or broadcast television.
And going back to your point about babies, I think if people would just stop acting like massive infants all the time, that would solve a lot of the problems that we're talking about, really. You just make your own decisions. Don't get too upset about things. Everything will be fine, but apparently not. Make sure you never miss a Spiked article by signing up to Today on Spiked. Today on Spiked is our essential daily newsletter. It goes out every weekday evening with a roundup of all of the articles and podcasts that we published that day. And there's also some exclusive commentary from the Spiked team. To sign up, just go to spiked-online.com/newsletters. That's spiked-online.com/newsletters.
Right, well, we better move on to our postbag section, which, of course, has its own jingle.
Postbag, postbag, postbag. It's bulging, isn't it?
And we should say, if you want your questions answered next time around, do email them in to lastorders@spiked-online.com. That's lastorders@spiked-online.com. But anyway, we've got some sort of selection of questions across various different topics, so bear with us. But it's a question for both of you, really. So this is getting in touch, talking about our last episode with Rod Liddell, which he really enjoyed. He says, Rod Liddell coined the phrase peak wank with regards to current culture and politics, which I suppose, you know, could basically mean peak woke, I suppose, is more or less what he's talking about. Do you think, let's start with you, Chris, that we're approaching or nearing peak wank?
With the woke thing? I don't know. Yeah, probably, maybe. I don't know. I don't know. I've just been reading Andrew Doyle's book, which is very, very good. The New Puritans, really, really good. We see what the interesting thing for me is, I'm trying to think like an economist about this, is how does this, you know, the system of cancel culture and no platforming and, you know, stigmatizing and destroying people's life, there's so few people benefit from it, you wouldn't think it was sustainable, right? It seems like a sort of a pyramid scheme. Like the number of people who actually benefit from it are basically a bunch of, you know, mentally ill spinsters in higher education and people who are like grifting with, you know, doing diversity courses, and, you know, a tiny handful of people who probably wouldn't be able to find much in the way of work without this. Whereas everybody else suffers to varying degrees. And even the people who are kind of in the movement must live in constant fear of being cancelled or having some tweet from 10 years previous suddenly come to light. So there's so few people benefit from it, and so many people paying the costs of it or live in fear of it, you wouldn't think it would be sustainable, right? And the number of people who really directly badly affected by this are probably quite few. It's the people who are being, you know, driven out of their jobs. It's female swimmers being forced to swim against biological males and stuff like that. But the point that Andrew makes in his book, I think he would probably broadly agree with me about this, but he says, you know, the cost of being called, for example, a racist is still very high, ironically, because we're not a racist society, despite what the social justice warriors think. And so I guess there's this climate of fear. And of course, his book, if you've read it, you know, it starts and ends with the Salem witch trials, which seems a bit overdramatic, but actually there's some pretty nice little parallels there. And, you know, those girls who were accusing people of witchcraft were very successful for quite a while until they started accusing people in power. And, you know, once they'd kind of outlived their usefulness, they were completely ignored and shunned. So, I mean, I think it's very possible to see a tipping point with this. And there are now enough people who have kind of had it with the movement. You would think that we might be reaching that tipping point. On the other hand, it is so embedded in, you know, the civil service, in lots of businesses, in the education system in particular, that I don't know. It's quite possible that this relatively small number of people, this concentrated interest group, will be able to keep out the broader interests of most people.
What do you think, Nick?
I agree with Chris completely that, you know, the real mystery is that fewer and fewer people benefit because, you know, as you cancel more people, like there's just the couple of, you know, people who get to call the shots. And like, I mean, this happened somewhat in America with, I think, the Black Lives Matter movement. They started saying, okay, well, you know, we're about people of color, but really only Black lives mattered. So Asian Americans were like, well, what's in it for us if we're doing identity politics and you're telling me I'm actually white? Like, so I'm outside the circle that gets the benefits. So they started pushing back on that. I mean, I think the way this ends is there's going to be the final two people are going to be conjoined twins. And, you know, everybody else has been canceled because they're the last people in the directorate of this revolution. And then they're going to turn to each other and say, like, no, you are the problem and you have to get out. And then they kill each other because they can't, you know, they can't survive disconjoined. I interviewed Andrew Doyle for Reason. He's a fantastic talker and whatnot about the New Puritans. The interview is up on our website as video and audio, but he talks specifically at the end of the book about what he calls an Ipswich Bridge moment, which is when the girls who were at the heart of the accusations of the Salem witch trials, as they literally left Salem and they walked across a bridge and they went into another town. And somehow the spell was broken and people were like, the kind of adults in the room were like, why are we listening to you? Like, it doesn't make any sense. And the fever broke and that was just the end of it. And he is slightly hopeful that we're getting closer to that Ipswich Bridge moment. I am too, in the sense of it's going to be institutionalized. It already is in like certain kinds of corporations and certainly in academia and in K-12. And that will linger on for decades because there's a lot of inertia. But when you look at places like Spotify and Netflix, you know, a year ago or more recently, they were challenged to say, like, get rid of these people because they are bad people because they said this or their art is this way or whatever. And it was interesting to see Netflix with Dave Chappelle, Spotify with Joe Rogan, you know, and there are other examples where they were like, hey, how about this? Go fuck yourself. And if you don't like what we're putting out, don't watch it. So I'm confident we'll be there. We don't know when. But I like the idea of that Ipswich Bridge moment, you know, coming soon.
Well, I'm also hopeful for the UK for a lot of this stuff, even in terms of our institutions. It's been quite positive. Recently, take something like the trans kids issue, you know, the sudden acceptability over the past 5 years that you should give puberty blockers to, you know, 9-year-olds and so on and so forth. That's been more or less pushed out of the NHS, already one of the worst institutions for groupthink and terrible ideologies. And, you know, I think it is only a matter of time before the schools get, there's more of a debate about what's going on with those issues. So even on those kind of institutions, there's a bit more of a kind of positive direction to that.
If I may, by the way, this is also the type of thing that might speed it along. The New York Marathon, which has been going on, I think, since like 1969, was recently run. You know, and they have men's and women's categories. And unlike the Boston Marathon, which for years wouldn't allow women to run, you know, I think the New York was co-ed from the beginning, but they had a non-binary category. So it was, you know, men, women, and non-binary. All of the money winners were born men. And that type of thing is going to erode support for the most extreme versions. I believe in, I think that adults should have the right to transform their bodies however they see fit. I have friends who have done full gender reassignment surgery and they are happier for it. I have others who they did that and their lives are still kind of complicated. You know, like I'm pro adults doing whatever they want to their body as they see fit, you know, and the question then is kids. But I think things like that, the New York Marathon having a non-binary category, and it is just a way for biological men who were not going to win in the men's division take home money, like that will speed this along.
And finally, as we've got two noted libertarians on this podcast today, we should ask the question. So it's a question about drug legalization that says, should the UK?
Yes, the answer is yes. The answer is yes.
But what do you think is like a savvy strategy for doing that? Do you go all in at once? Or is it something that you would stage? You pick maybe the easier targets off. Chris, what do you think?
Well, yeah, you pick the easy targets off. I mean, it's never going to happen. So, you know, it's very much hypothetical. Yeah, if we can get cannabis legalized in Britain, that would be obviously a great start. And that is clearly doable because lots of other places are doing it. But I think beyond that, there's very, very little demand. I know The Economist recently came out and said we should legalize cocaine, which is quite cool. Every now and again, The Economist comes out with a sound view.
Oh, I loved it when they said Joe Biden was going to pardon a bunch of, you know, federal prisoners who were in for simple possession of marijuana. And they said he's too timid.
Yeah.
You should legalize cocaine. Like, obviously, somebody at The Economist has a pretty big coke habit. Right.
That would not surprise me.
Well, I wouldn't like to say on that. But yeah, look, The Economist has about 3 or 4, you know, genuinely brave opinions. Like it's very keen on allowing athletes to use drugs in the Olympics for some reason. So it's what they have a few cool opinions, which they occasionally wheel out. And this one was, yeah, we should legalize cocaine. The Colombian government or the Colombian prime minister, president, whatever, recently said they should legalize cocaine. I mean, that's, you know, it makes a lot of sense from them, from an economic point of view, I guess. I can't realistically see it. You might maybe persuade governments to legalize mushrooms, perhaps. Maybe a push MDMA sometime in 50 years. But the rest of it wouldn't happen. But yeah, I mean, clearly the softy approach is the only vaguely realistic way of going about it.
You know, in the United States, we've effectively legalized cannabis, and it took decades, you know, and I mean, it took decades since California first passed medical marijuana in 1996 to get to a place where a majority of Americans now live in states where recreational pot is legal. In the midterm elections, Colorado legalized the use of magic mushrooms in certain kinds of settings, and they decriminalized possession. That is the next stage, basically legalizing plant-based psychedelics or decriminalizing them. What is interesting is that, and I'm pretty active in the drug legalization movement and the psychedelic movement, and people think, okay, well, we did it with pot, so now we just, it'll be easier and quicker with the next drug. But people don't do drugs the way libertarians do drugs or think about drug policy, where it's like, well, it worked for weed, especially in places like Colorado, which had a good tax and regulation and retail structure. It's an obvious win for everybody. It reduces crime. It actually reduced teen use. It generates tax revenue. Let's do this for all of them. But that isn't the way it works. And so, for instance, you know, people who are okay with legalizing weed might have no experience with psychedelics. And they're like, oh, psychedelics, that's practically heroin, which, you know, shouldn't be legal. So it's unfortunately, until maybe towards the end of we go through the whole pharmacopoeia, you're going to have to kind of replicate the same legalization process over and over again. What has changed in the U.S., which is interesting, and I don't know how this plays out in England, but psychedelics have been, you know, more successful. There's a bunch of jurisdictions that have decriminalized them or have passed a ballot initiative saying that enforcing laws against psychedelics should be the lowest police priority. Part of that is because psychedelics are not used by that many people, so they're not that threatening. And there is an older baby boom, which remembered taking psychedelics at some point or wanted to when they were younger. Now they're wealthy and they have a lot of free time. And I think COVID, it was like, I don't want to watch Tiger King on Netflix. I'm going to trip. And that's been pushing things along. And there is, in the United States, a lot of drug legalization efforts have, I think, wisely not just taken, you know, a kind of philosophical viewpoint that I have a right to change my mind to make how I feel better. It's much more cost-benefit analysis driven. And people recognize that the war on drugs, as it has been prosecuted in its more recent iteration for the past 50 years, but really for the entire length of the American experiment, just doesn't pass the dumbest cost-benefit analysis. And people are starting to think, you know, more in those terms. So I think drug legalization will continue to proceed, but not at the pace which I think rightfully it should, because, you know, the longer the drug war goes on, it's kind of like, you know, the longer you let Imperial Japan exist in World War II, like every month, X number of people were being killed, you know, by occupation, or the longer you let COVID go on without vaccines, X number of people are dying. Every month that the drug war continues, X number of people's lives are being ruined that have a ripple effect that will last for decades into the future. So we need the fierce urgency of now on drug legalization. Things are moving in the right direction, but I would love you, maybe if we could legalize cocaine or methamphetamine or something like that, we could pick up the pace and drive all the way to, you know, Berlin or, you know, to the Yalu River much faster than we are at the current time.
Certainly feels a world away from the UK. I think even if we managed to legalize cannabis, we'd probably have to make alcohol legal or something in exchange to the day.
Yeah,
or something like that.
I mean, that, you know, one of the best strategies that drug legalizers in the U.S. have done is to say, let's regulate this substance, you know, and it could be weed, it could be MDMA, it could be whatnot. Partly, a lot of it is in a medical context. So like MDMA is about to be approved sometime over the next 2 years for MDMA assisted therapy. So it's a medicalization. And as a Foucauldian libertarian, I'm a little bit worried about, you know, drugs being always legalized in a medical context. So, you know, it's a form of social control, but I'll take it. But it's also the, you know, it's the idea that we are so used to taking so many drugs in America. You know, you take an SSRI not to be depressed, and you take Adderall in order to have a little more speed. You take a drug to lower your cholesterol. Like in the past 50 years, the American drug chest, like, you know, has just opened up. Everybody in America is on like two or three or four drugs. So in that way, you can say, well, let's add this one more. You don't have to take it, but the people who want to take it will be good for them. And the social harms will be lessened if it's legal and regulated and, you know, comes from a reliable source that can also be liable if they adulterate the product.
Brilliant. So on that optimistic note, we'll end it. Chris, Nick, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.